This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. Tonight, our guest is Laura Gladson. She's a PhD candidate with the Department of Environmental Medicine, New York University's Grossman School of Medicine, New York University, and a research scholar, Marion Institute of Urban Management at NYU.
Laura is also a Chico resident whom we met via Zoom a few weeks ago at the get-together of the Environmental Coalition of Butte County at the This Way to Sustainability Conference. Her research interests include air quality, health effects of air pollution, policy-driven research, translational research, and environmental justice, the latter a topic we're especially interested in addressing. Welcome, Laura Gladson.
Hi, thank you. Happy to be here.
We're all aware of air pollution to some degree, including general agreement that California may have the worst air quality in the country. But a little like fish in water, we often know very little about the environment in which we swim. We thought we'd open the show. Perhaps you could give us a brief course in Air Pollution 101.
Sure, absolutely. So just starting out, what is air pollution? When we talk about it, I think we just kind of have this vague understanding usually of what that is, but generally it's anything in the air that you're going to breathe in that's going to cause harm to your body. And we can split the main pollutants that we usually look at into two main groups. The first would be particulate matter, and that's going to be suspended solids or liquids in the air. And then you're going to have your gases as our second group. And so that first group, particulate matter, or PM, you may have heard it called, is what we usually refer to it as. This can be all kinds of things. This can be dust blown up from deserts. This can be tiny pieces of tire that's been worn on the road that's now suspended in the air. This can be from industrial combustion activities, which is something we're especially concerned with. And obviously, this could be from wildfire burning. So what's important to understand about PM is that we don't typically define it actually by what specific, you know, element it's made out of or what it is exactly, but we tend to categorize it by its size or by its average diameter. And so especially with coronavirus, I think a lot of us have started to hear a lot more of this term PM2.5. In reference to a specific kind of particulate matter. And so PM2.5, the 2.5 is referring to that diameter. And so it's a 2.5 microns or micrometers or smaller is what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So just to kind of give you a visual, we can't see this. Too small to see. It's actually about 1/100th of a single human hair. This is how big or small, I should say, these things mm-hmm. are. And so the reason that we're concerned with PM2.5 specifically, or just generally these very small particles, is that the smaller the particle is, the deeper it can reach into our lungs. And PM2.5 specifically can actually get into those tiny little air sacs in our lungs and cross over, you know, that barrier into the bloodstream, that that exchange pathway where typically carbon dioxide and oxygen are exchanged. So that's kind of the big one that we tend to do a lot of research in. There's a lot of research on PM2.5. There's a bit of a debate, I guess you could say, in the scientific community about how important the actual components of the particulate matter are. And there's, you know, there's research into that. We just don't necessarily have the kind of monitoring infrastructure at the moment to really know what that is on kind of a national or global scale. And then if we're going to look at that second big group of pollutants, we're looking at our gases. And so this might include nitrogen dioxide. A lot of that comes from traffic. This can include sulfur dioxide. A lot of that comes from coal-burning power plants, and it's also the cause of acid rain. And then also a big one is ozone, those three oxygen molecule or atoms bound together. And this one is important, but also can be a little confusing because a lot of us have heard of the ozone layer and something we want to keep intact, and that's true. The ozone layer is up in the stratosphere that's protecting us from harmful UV radiation. But here on the ground where we live, we don't necessarily want that ozone because when we breathe it in, it can cause a lot of respiratory harm. Kind of the lay term for ozone is smog. And the reason for this is you often get ozone from traffic. So ozone is what we would call a secondary pollutant. We don't actually produce it directly, but it's a product of these gases that often come from motor vehicle emissions and other combined with sunlight. So that reaction actually creates ozone. So we can probably understand why our California cities, lots of traffic, lots of sun, we're getting a lot of smog that we need to worry about. And Steve and Susan, I'm just going to say, I'm not even going to touch on indoor air pollution tonight. We're just going to focus on outdoor because that's just a whole another episode, I think,
oh,
on its
dear.
Own.
We'll have to have you back.
But, yeah. So I think then kind of our second big thing to think about with air pollution is how is it actually hurting us? And so we can also kind of divide these health effects of air pollution into two groups. We can think about our short-term effects, and we can think about our long-term effects. So those short-term or acute effects that we feel, they're going to occur within a few days. So, you know, you might have some respiratory symptoms, maybe an asthma exacerbation if you have asthma, you know, potentially being in the hospital, but then, you know, at some point you're able to recover pretty quickly and you're done. So that's kind of our short-term effects. But this is important. We see this with ozone, particularly in children with asthma, lots of other respiratory symptoms, depending on, like, your current level of disease or no disease. And then we also see important long-term impacts. You know, repeated exposures to these pollutants, you're going to be seeing heart attacks, death, development of respiratory and cardiovascular diseases, and even cancers. And something that's been recent in some of the literature is actually a connection to poor mental health. So air pollution and depression, air pollution and anxiety. Yeah. So, you know, when we talk about PM2.5, you know, and some of these others getting into your bloodstream, you mean you're essentially giving it access to your entire body. PM in particular, we've seen PM2.5 can cross that blood-brain barrier. We see what are even smaller particles than that we would call ultrafines. There's been studies in rats where those ultrafines are actually going through the olfactory nerve and getting into the brain just through your nose. So I think, yeah, I don't think a lot of people are aware that it's not just your lungs that are being affected by this. Should I just keep talking? I've got a lot I can say about this.
I just had a question.
If you guys have any questions.
I do have a question. I do have a question. Is there like a hierarchy of dangers? You know, we say these are the most dangerous things, and then can people work out if they know what that hierarchy is, what's most important to avoid? And then I have another question that is all about me. And that is, ever since the campfire, I've had a cough, and I don't have any other symptoms of, you know, shortness of breath or anything like that, but I cough all the time. Can you have effects like that from a fire that just continue even if it's not? And we were, of course, in the midst of it, so.
Yeah, certainly.
And then our house was, you know, we came back to our house after several months, and everything was smoky outside.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that was a very high pollution concentration event. You have a lot of, you know, PM, very highly concentrated in the air, and you know, if you're breathing that in for quite a few days, that could affect you. And there's, you know, every single person is different. When you think about your personal risk, you have to think about your age. You have to think about any pre-existing diseases that you might have. You know, everybody's body even works differently. You know, exactly. So really generally, yes, higher concentrations are important. repeated exposures are important. You know, the longer you're exposed, you know, it's hard to compare because you might be comparing someone who's exposed to just kind of moderate levels of pollution, but it's every single day, you know,
maybe near a heavy
traffic road versus maybe you were exposed to the campfire for quite a few days, but that's like a pretty intense event. So you might see those symptoms go away at some point. You know, maybe you're kind of between like a, you know, maybe a longer acute impact, you might say, but I'm not necessarily clinician, so I don't know specifically, but that's kind of what we're seeing. You know, you have to think about a lot of different factors going into it.
And then back to my question that's really more important than my particular health.
Oh, yeah,
health.
I forgot. That's a hierarchy
Which
question,
is,
right?
Is there a hierarchy both with the particulates mm-hmm. and with the gases?
So for the particulates, that one would be easier to answer. So uh-huh. generally, the smaller the diameter of the particle, the more dangerous it's going to be. Okay. And that's simply because your larger particles are going to be trapped by your nasal passages. They have a lot of filtration. And if they get past that, or if you breathe it in through your mouth, they're going to possibly settle because of their mass. You know, gravity is still a thing inside your lungs.
Right.
They may run into the walls of your lung passages. You know, we have those kind of upside down tree branches. So as the air is flowing, if they have enough mass, they're going to, you know, slam to the wall and they're stuck. They can't go any farther down. So reversing that, then the very small particles can get deeper. And that's really why that's such an important factor. So yes, smaller particles generally, but you also have to think about factors such as the shape, because we like to think of them all as these perfect little spheres, but that's not true. You can have like asbestos is actually a very long fiber, very, very thin, and it's especially dangerous. This is an indoor air pollutant, but it's an example to illustrate. That can kind of weave its way through the airflow very deep into your lungs, and then actually your immune cells are trying to consume that and get rid of it, and it winds up just killing the immune cell. They can't handle it.
Right.
So the shape, yes. And, you know, the charge of the particle can make a difference. And PM can actually carry other gases as well. And even other, you know, just elements that are kind of sticking to it, getting in you. So, you know, once again, a lot of different factors going on. But, you know, just for sort of a layman's perspective, I think the size is really a key for that one. And then for the gases, it's a little different because they just each have different effects. But the big ones that we think about in terms of human health would be ozone and NO2. But NO2 is typically more of a marker for other things in the air. But really, when we look, you know, most of my research is PM2.5 and ozone. Those are kind of the two big ones that we're concerned about. All of these are... the federal government has set standards for 6 criteria pollutants for outdoor air.
Okay.
So PM2.5, but they also monitor PM10, ozone, NO2, SO2, and also lead and carbon monoxide. So those are kind of the big ones that are important to kind of the people making these rules. So
Laura, how do you measure that? Let's move on to that part of our discussion.
Sure.
As I mentioned, we talked with Sean DeGuzman from the Department of Water Resources a little while ago about measuring the snowpack, and incredibly complex, all kinds of measurements, plus trying to extrapolate from what you measure. Tell us a little bit about how you measure air pollution here in California or elsewhere.
Sure. So a disclaimer, I actually don't do these measurements myself. I'm the person who takes all that great data and plays with it on my computer, but I do know how this works. And so there's three kind of big groups, again, of how we can measure it. The historical and most direct way is obviously to measure air quality on the ground. And so the kind of the gold standard of this, and this is what is used to determine if your county meets the law, the federal laws for air quality, is the stationary filter monitors for PM. And just how this works is you have a vacuum, it's pulling air into this device, you have a filter inside to gather the PM on the surface, And if you're trying to just get PM 2.5, you have specific inlets and filtration steps to make sure you're just getting the size fraction that you want. So you're just going to get particles that are 2.5 micrometers in diameter or smaller. And so what you do with these filters is you weigh them. So beforehand and after they're exposed, you weigh them and you get the difference in the mass. And the thing about this is it's very delicate because we're working with these very tiny particles. And so you have these very light, thin filters. You have to weigh them in a very special room with temperature and humidity being controlled. You know, you have a big marble table so that you don't get these vibrations while you're measuring it. You have to neutralize the charges. You have to, you know, like anything, have your controls. You have your blank filters that are not exposed to air, but take it around with you as you're doing everything to make sure you're not contaminating your sample filters. So you need to have highly trained folks to do this. The equipment's very expensive. So that's kind of the big standard for how to do that. And obviously we can also get different elemental measurements of PM2 if we want to know exactly what it's made out of. So then for the gaseous pollutants, it's somewhat similar. You have a kind of substance in a tube or something, and the gas will absorb onto it, and so you can measure the rate. But what's important to all this, you have to know how long it's exposed. You have to know how quickly that air is being pulled through so you can actually determine the amount of pollution per volume of air. So there's a lot of math that goes into it, but that's kind of the gist of how that works at the ground level. Like I said, and this is actually a big part of what I'm going to talk about a little later, some of my research is that these ground monitors have a very large region that they're covering. You know, this can be like a city size, you know, one monitor for the city. So the big issue here is you're not getting these street level measurements. You know, you can get pollution mm-hmm. that kind of sits in a street, or you can get, you know, a certain industry or something that's just kind of surrounding it, get kind of stuck there. So there's been a big push for more low cost sensors on the ground. No, some of these are just, you know, not as great of technology, but it still works, maybe less precise. You know, your measurements have a larger confidence interval, but you can get a lot more of them for less money. There's some that are handheld, and you can actually get an instantaneous reading. So for PM, instead of using the filters for that, you might use a light scattering method. So they shine a beam, and kind of the extinction of that beam can tell you how much PM is in the sample. Mm-hmm. So that's the gist of the ground monitoring, and that's kind of the traditional way that we measure it.
I just wanted to jump in briefly and mention, a few years ago, I went to a conference of the CPUP, Chemical Education for Public Understanding, and a teacher there gave a report. She'd sent kids out with tongue depressors, which they smeared with Vaseline, and they put them all over the city as a really rough measure of the particulate content.
The kids
brought them in, and then they correlated it with neighborhoods, and they did discover that the poorer, more crowded neighborhoods had more particulate matter than the cleaner suburbs. So I thought it was a great way to alert kids to this issue.
Yeah, that's really great. That absolutely ties into what we're going to be talking about here with environmental justice. And we know that what those kids observe, we know that that's essentially a fact. You know, we observe this across the country. And so I'm just going to touch on a couple more ways we measure pollution. And the reason that we've got these actually is because a lot of parts of the world, and especially, you know, our low and middle income countries in the global south don't have good ground monitoring networks. And so we still want to get measurements for those because, you know, data is how we make things better. You know, we need to know what's going on. And so a really cool way we do this is from space on satellite. You can put air pollution monitors on a satellite, and they can measure the PM and the gas concentrations on the surface of the Earth that way. There's obviously a lot of challenges with this. It's very far away. You might have clouds in the way. You might only get observations a couple times a day, but they've gotten really, really have improved greatly over the last several years, and this is like a really promising kind of passed for the monitoring field. And then kind of our third way is using models, so we can use our understanding of chemistry, of weather patterns, of geography to determine or predict essentially what the pollution is going to be in different places at different times. And the cool thing about all of this, none of these methods are perfect by themselves, but we can actually combine them. So some of the work I've done was using satellite data that's been combined with a model to give us much more detailed data to be able to look more closely inside neighborhoods and see what's going on.
Does your training include a lot of statistical analysis and algorithms for this sort of thing?
Yeah, so let me just touch on that, actually. So there is actually a newer algorithm called MIAC from NASA. It is an algorithm, and it's a model, so it takes that satellite data and apply some of that understanding of, you know, chemistry and land dispersion, and can refine it even more. So maybe you have a resolution of several kilometers mm-hmm. from the satellite data, mm-hmm. but then that's now brought it down to 1 kilometer. So you have a 1 kilometer grid for, and my data is for the entire state of California.
Oh, mm-hmm. wow.
So, yeah. Yes, that's been really helpful. Should I just dive into that right now?
Yeah, go.
I think that would be, yeah. So, so this is what's interesting. We wanted to look at, you know, how, you know, what's going on between the ground monitors. You know, how much variation pollution? Are there spikes that we're missing? And so this satellite data combined with this model that we were, some colleagues of ours put this together. And so we have this data and we can look at it and kind of compare it to the ground monitors and say, is this giving us a lot more information than the ground monitors, or maybe they're doing okay, you know? So, because we want to put our resources where they matter. If we're going to try to go into these, you know, neighborhoods and get better data, we want to know where we need to start measuring. And so specifically, I think we should step back and actually talk about environmental justice a little bit more before we jump into the project. I'm not sure if you've already talked about this on the show before.
No.
But do you know what, do we have an understanding of what environmental justice is, or what do you
think? I think you should talk a little bit about environmental justice.
A little more 101.
Yeah.
I don't know who's in our audience.
Far ahead here. I've been really happy to see environmental justice, like that term, popping up more in the last year with a lot of these big issues we've been talking about as a nation. But at its core, environmental justice efforts are addressing unequal distributions of environmental risk in our society. So we're obviously not all exposed to the same things. You can think of, you know, there's communities who live near heavy industry. There are communities live near high traffic roads or highways or near mines. Those people are, we know, suffering from greater health impacts. And we also know that they on average have lower incomes. They are often a higher proportion Black or Latino or Indigenous. People who have been historically marginalized and had economic opportunity withheld from them. Ultimately, they're dealing with racism, they're dealing with voter suppression and poor legal representation. So when they speak up and try to stop industries from building, try to stop, you know, a city from building a big highway through their neighborhood, they're pretty much ignored most of the time, at least historically, and we see it happening all the time still. We see it in Flint, Michigan, you know,
seven years
without clean water. Can you imagine that happening here? No, like, you can't imagine that happening here. But these neighborhoods are, their city doesn't have money. This Flint is over half the population is Black. I read this really great book talking about the redlining that went on mm-hmm. in that city. They're essentially denied loans historically because they were a risk. And so, mm-hmm. you know, they just don't have legal or political or financial power to say anything. So that's the whole idea behind environmental justice mm-hmm. is address finding out where these neighborhoods and communities are and fixing this inequality in health risk from environmental awesome.
I'd like to throw in another example, if I may. We lived in Lansing, Michigan, East Lansing, Michigan, for a while, and fascinating research came out, and this would be 15, 20 years ago, measuring air pollution levels, the gases, next to one of the expressways, the Interstate 895 bypass, and discovered, yes, very heavy levels of pollution close to the expressway, and that's, of course, where the poorer neighborhoods were. Usually, typically, expressways come right through poorer neighborhoods instead of the affluent suburbs.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what a lack of environmental justice looks like.
Yes.
Another example, I guess we could say, is the Keystone Pipeline. You know, you have these indigenous communities trying to protest that, and, you know, we know those industrial activities are causing environmental spills and risks. It's happening in real time, and they're still building them. So, I mean, that's just another big example. So something cool, though, that's going on here in California is the Community Air Protection Program. It was from Assembly Bill 617, and funding is specifically geared towards helping reduce the air pollution in communities, or the exposure in communities that are most impacted by air pollution. There's actually 13 communities that they're focusing on. There's some funding for other things, but 13 communities that are determined those that need help with this the most. And I actually looked at these 13 communities for this research. So we had the ground monitor data and that satellite data for these communities, and we were able to kind of see, are there hot spots the ground monitors are missing? Is it representing the pollution in these neighborhoods well, or do we need to put some funding towards better monitoring here? And I think you guys might be curious, but the closest one of these communities is down in Sacramento. So what we found, or what we're finding, is that the ground monitors actually do a pretty good job showing the day-to-day changes in air pollution. So on a temporal scale, when we're looking on a spatial scale, there's absolutely hot spots popping up that they simply can't capture. This is where I think it's really important that we have data for our communities. We need to know where to put our resources. We need to know where we need to set up low-cost networks, or where we want to put money towards clean technologies so that we can actually equalize some of this environmental exposure between communities.
That seems extraordinarily difficult. I'm thinking of remedying environmental injustice versus something like, as very much on our mind today, a police officer killing a black man. That's observable. Action can be taken. But with environmental pollution in a low-income neighborhood, it seems really difficult to take action to arouse public concern. So we'd be interested in hearing your views on that.
Yeah. The general issue with environmental things generally is that if you're doing a really good job as an environmental scientist or as a public health expert, then nobody knows that you're doing it. Nobody cares. Nobody knows, because everything's going smoothly. But and the other thing about this is humans generally tend to value immediate benefits over future benefits.
Right.
We can see this very clearly with climate change, how we just really don't care what's going to happen. Funny thing about that is those future benefits of climate change are fastly approaching or currently happening. But the same kind of thing with air pollution, and you layer that on top of, you know, systemic racism. People don't really care about what repeated exposure is going to do to them, you know, several years or decades down the road, and they definitely don't care if it's happening to someone else. Yes, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to implement that change if you don't have that financial power to, you know, sway those decisions, or you don't have that good political or legal representation to sway those decisions. So I think programs like California's CAPS program that I mentioned are really good, you know, ways to try and address that. And just generally, I very strongly believe in, you know, policies and programs that are data driven. I think a lot of times we make these policies and they're very reactionary. And I think that's important to an extent. But really good policy is based on data, because we do have limited resources and we really want to put those where it counts.
I wanted to, we'll come back to the social justice issue, but I wanted to just read briefly in one of your research papers. You said, since 1980, air pollution concentrations in the U.S. have steadily decreased, but thousands of excess deaths and tens of thousands of excess morbidities are still attributed to exposure each year. I have a couple questions there. What do you mean by morbidities, and what do you mean by excess? If you could help us understand that, then we could...
Yeah, absolutely. So your first question, morbidities. So that's a nice way to say, not a nice way, but another way to say diseases, or, you know, health impacts that aren't killing you, essentially. So that could be hospital admissions or ER visits. That could be an asthma. You know, someone's diagnosed with asthma, someone's diagnosed with lung cancer, you know, those kind of things, disease development, disease symptoms, heart attacks, all that is combined into morbidities. And so I think the morbidities tend to, the ones that we were accounting for in the report you're referencing, are typically about twice the number of deaths. And then that's, I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but we also account for impacted days, so people missing school or work because of symptoms from air pollution that's keeping them from it. Can you remind me of your second question?
Well, he asked about excess morbidity.
Which is really hard.
Oh, excess. Yeah. Absolutely. So you were reading from one of our Health of the Air reports, and this is something we do every year as we get new EPA monitoring data. And what we're looking at specifically is the impacts that we could have avoided if we were meeting a certain level of pollution. So the EPA has its national standards, but most of us in the air quality community think they're too high. We're seeing health impacts much at levels much lower than the EPA requires counties to meet. And so we work with the American Thoracic Society, who has their own recommended standards, and these are what we're basing our research off of. So we're looking at every county in the U.S. We're looking at what it's based on 3 years of monitoring data. So we're looking at what its average pollution levels are for PM and ozone, and we are then kind of creating this imaginary scenario where that county actually met with the ATS wants us all to meet, that level that they recommend, and seeing, you know, that kind of that gap of pollution, how many deaths, how many morbidities, how many days were occurring because of that section of air pollution. Does that make sense?
So
that's,
yes.
That's the excess. The interesting thing about this is we actually have not yet observed a lower level of pollution where we don't see health impacts. So what people consider low pollution, you still get health impacts. There's not a safe level. We have not observed a safe level. And so essentially, you know, those numbers that you were looking at, that's probably not all of them. There's very likely health impacts occurring at levels even lower than the ATS recommends, or even lower than, you know, the EPA requires, obviously, but that we're not accounting for. But the purpose behind our reports is to kind of give our local, you know, air quality managers and our policymakers just some information, like, hey, if you were able to lower our pollution in our county to this level, we would save this many lives a year. We would save this many, you know, people from going to the hospital or getting asthma or missing work because of air pollution every year.
Can that be translated into costs as well? I'm thinking that people might
be persuaded.
Yeah.
Actually, we use a program that is created by the EPA called BenMap. It's a benefits, and, you know, it's map. You can predict, you put in your air pollution, the differences, like I talked about, and you get the health impacts, like what we were talking about. There's a third step you can do in there that they will put that into a monetary value, the cost, the financial cost. That's not something we did part of our research, but it's definitely something you can look at. You get into all kinds of things with that based on the value, you know, the value of statistical life factor, how much, you know, how much is a human life worth? There's all kinds of I guess ethical considerations there too, because value of statistical life of someone in America is more than in a country that has a lower GDP on average. So is that really an ethical way to look at that? But yes, you definitely can. The EPA, however, is legally not allowed to consider financial costs when they are revising their standards. They're supposed to revise their standards every 4 years. They are not legally, according to the Clean Air Act, allowed to consider financial monetary costs of reducing air pollution. Mm-hmm. So it's a really, really cool part of the Clean Air Act, actually.
We wanted to ask a little more about the environmental justice question or debate.
Well,
if you, go ahead, Susan.
No, go ahead.
If you were the air pollution czar, and we hope you that will be a job you get at one of these points, what specific mandates would you issue, or what would be your ideal view of how the states and the cities could move forward to reduce environmental injustice?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think, like I mentioned before, I would want to look at what data do we have on these locations? What do we know about the locations that do we know where the locations even are, and do we know of their existence? And then once we can get good information on who's experiencing, you know, a lot of environmental injustice, then trying to target those areas, you know, allocating our funding in ways that are really doing the most, you know, having the greatest impact for the dollar's worth, I guess you could say, because of course all these, administrators and air quality managers are really limited by their funding. So that's a big thing to consider. Other than that, I think there's a lot of something we haven't touched on actually is how this relates to climate change, and I think there's I think there's a huge opportunity to combine efforts on this, because they're not exactly the same thing. When you talk about air pollution, you know, we're talking about things that actually directly harm us, you breathe it in. With climate change, you know, we're concerned with greenhouse gases that heat the world, and then that indirectly, you know, can affect our health in numerous ways. But often, you know, the sources of these greenhouse gases and sources of air pollution are the same. You know, you can think of coal-fired power plants putting out tons of CO2, also putting out tons of PM, you know? So you can really target these same sources, and you can, you know, use a lot of the same, you know, emissions reduction or clean technologies to address both of these things at the same time. So I really think we usually call that the co-benefits of climate change with air pollution.
I wanted to go back just for a second to AB 617. Could you describe what it does?
Oh, yes. So it was passed in 2017. It led to the California Air Resources Board to creating the Community Air Protection Program. And the program's focus is to reduce exposure in those communities most impacted by air pollution. And it provides funding for monitoring, which is obviously a big focus of what my research was looking at. It provides funding for cleaner technologies, for local grants, for improved enforcement of, you know, reducing those emissions. There's also funding through the Assembly Bill outside of these 13 communities I talked about. So there's funding for disadvantaged census blocks. We actually have a couple of these here in Butte County. I know there was a meeting by the Butte County Air Quality Management District several weeks ago. They have funding for, you know, local community projects to try and address emissions, you know, in our county. So there's a lot of different things going on going on with it, essentially.
One of the things that, as a former academic myself, one of the things that's always troubled me is how the best research that's being done in universities takes a long time to move mm-hmm. into policy. And mm-hmm. I wonder if you've seen some of the things that you've worked on move into policy, move into the kind of political realm, and what you think about the efforts of researchers to make sure that that happens.
Yeah, this is, I'm really glad you asked that. I actually kind of work, the Marin Institute where I work, specifically our air quality department, really works kind of at the intersection of science and policy. Our research is very policy driven and also driven by just the needs of communities. You know, a lot of times science is just, you know, you have an interesting question, you want to answer it.
Right.
Which is important, and you know, that's kind of like drives the curious heart of a scientist. But I do think it's really important what's actually needed in the world and what kind of research do we need to do to answer the questions that are needed to, you know, address, you know, how do we make a good policy? So to answer your question of some specific examples, just kind of like one very specific example would be, I did a small project where we were looking at different ways to kind of design the form of the national PM2.5 standard, the short-term standard. There's different levels of it. But we went through and we were like, hey, if we, you know, based it on the maybe the 95th percentile instead of the 98th percentile, mm-hmm. you know, of how it's determined, this could actually overall reduce air pollution while making it easier for local communities to, like, reduce their emissions. So it's different things like that. And so that small little project wound up being presented to the American Thoracic Society. They changed their recommendation. Those recommendations, you know, are seen by the EPA, by local community leaders. So just like putting, you know, so that's kind of how our research is going. With our Health of the Air, we actually have all of our results posted on a website, healthoftheair.org.
Oh, so wow, that's great.
Yes. So you can search that. They're currently last year's numbers, and we're going to update them soon. We have the fourth report kind of in the works right now. But so we can have local air quality managers plug in their county. They can see how many deaths, morbidities, days, every year could be avoided if they met the ATS recommendations for air quality in the county. It's also divided by PM and ozone. We put out lists of the top cities in the country with the most to gain if they were able to lower their emissions. So that's just an example of some of the kind of work mm-hmm. that we're doing regarding that.
Yep, that sounds really great to me.
yeah, it's interesting. I should give a little disclaimer. This isn't your personal risk from living.
Right.
Yeah, it depends on not only the pollution of the local area, but the population. So, you know, we could have the same pollution level
sure.
as somewhere in Wyoming, but we have much higher numbers here because, you know, there's a higher population.
What will be the next step in your personal research?
Yeah, so I'm particularly very interested in wildfire emissions. The interesting thing about what I was just talking about, this health of the air, and a lot of other research is they exclude wildfire emissions. And the reason for that is it's considered an exceptional event by the EPA. So mm-hmm. counties do not have to count days had very high emissions from wildfires or, you know, other kind of extreme events that were outside of their control. Hmm. You know, they don't want to get punished for not meeting the standard because they had a wildfire. But the thing is, people are still being exposed to those wildfires and their emissions. And so we're hopefully going to be getting some new satellite data on wildfire emissions. And that's kind of my next step, is probably going to be looking at that with some of our Health of the Air stuff in the next year. And kind of going to be incorporating that to some other work I'm doing. And obviously living here, just moved here to Chico a few months ago. Very, very interested in learning more about that. Very relevant,
right,
obviously,
yeah.
to us mm-hmm. being here.
Well, you know what? Stick around. There's going to be more.
sure. I'm prepping my, you know, wildfire kits and stuff here in my house. So.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay.
Well, Thank you very much, Laura. We hope you'll come back and talk with us again sometime when you get more data, more insights, more recommendations, particularly for the environmental justice aspect of your work. Our guest on Ecotopia has been Laura Gladson. She works at New York University. She's a research scholar at the Marin Institute. And again, their website is healthoftheair.com. And we appreciate your being here in Chico and appreciate your being with us on Ecotopia this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.